You're listening to the Slavic Literature Pod, your shelf help guide to all things Slavic.
I'm Matt Garasimovich, PhD candidate at Northwestern University, studying Russian literature and film.
And I'm Cameron Lalana, a literature enthusiast and guy working in media. We're two friends who met studying in Russia. We like talking about books so much that we made it into a podcast.
And the podcast is the podcast for people who want to learn more about Slavic literature, art, and culture. Every episode, we're going to be bringing you the background and analysis you'll need to know to understand these works.
If you're interested in supporting us, you can head on over to our website, slaviclitpod.com. All right, Matt, what are we getting into this week?
This week, we have a sort of two-for-one special edition episode, which is exciting.
That's the value you get from the Slavic Literature Pod.
Yes, all value. That's right. This week, we're going to be reading Daniil Harms' short story, How the Old Woman Was Shopping for Ink, or some variation of that title, depending on the translation you're reading. This week, we're joined by special guest Maya Vinokur, who's here to talk about this story in the context of her new book, Workflows, Stalinist Liquids in Russian Labor Culture. Maya is an assistant professor in the Department of Russian and Slavic Studies at New York University and the author of the aforementioned book, Workflows, Stalinist Liquids in Russian Labor Culture. Her interests include Stalinism and Nazism, late Soviet science fiction, post-Soviet media, and the global far right. She recently published an article in Jacobin on a phenomenon she calls lifestyle fascism. Maya, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
We had it's hard. We had a joy reading your book, but it was it's given us a lot to think about, I think. Yeah. So I'm excited to talk about it.
Yes. So thank you so much for getting it to us. And I'd like to mention for all of our listeners who cannot see what we have, you should look up the book because it has some of the best, I think, cover art of any of the books we've ever covered on this. I'm a sucker for sort of this era of art, but it's just great.
Yes, me too. Yeah, Cornell did an amazing job.
Yeah, but yeah, super excited to get it. So thank you. Before, just as we're kind of getting into it, for our listeners who are, you know, first approaching the book, don't know what's going on, should they come into your book if they get it kind of expecting to read about?
They should expect a lot of close readings of literature from the 20s and 30s, Russian language, and they should also expect some maybe unexpected kinds of analysis and connections. Because as you saw in the book, I don't think that, I mean, Stalinism is certainly an interesting phenomenon in its own right, but I think it has some like surprising connections to our own lives here in beautiful America today. So if you want to learn more about this period in history, or you want to learn, you know, just some like theoretical implications of that history for the present day, those are things you can get from my book.
I was so interested in that. I don't have the question on Stalinism for you yet, but I have more later because I'm so interested in people that like really engage with it. I think there's a sort of tendency to kind of push away a little from actual engagement with it, as you know, it's bad. We don't need to talk about it too much, and I think there really is a lot that we're missing when we take that approach. So I like that for first off, I would say, and. My sort of first question on the book is how you describe the scope of it. So I have this quote from your introduction that says the book investigates the surprising ubiquity of the language of fluids, broadly understood to include both literal liquids like blood or water and more metaphorically flowing substances like electrical or cosmic energy at all levels of the Stalinist master text. So I'm kind of curious what led you into this framework for analysis. I mean, liquid, I think it's a very interesting and unique sort of approach to trying to understand this. And honestly, as I was reading this, I thought, yeah, that makes a lot of sense. There are a lot of these references throughout all of these works.
Well, that's actually what got me there is just, I wasn't looking for it, but reading a lot of the texts that I had been reading for years, for example, Harms, I'd been reading for I've been reading Harms since I was a child because he was also a children's author. And just like looking at these texts in the historical context of the 20s and 30s, which I became interested in pretty early, like in grad school at some point, and just realizing that there are all these, like, why are there so many references to liquids? Like, Like, how far does this go? Is it just in somebody weird and sort of marginal like comps, or can we find it elsewhere? And like, then the more I looked, the more I was like, oh my God, all of the work of, for instance, Andrei Platonov, where like so much of his work is about energy or flow or water or channeling. Then you look at like socialist realist works, and then you realize, well, actually the socialist realist works are partly describing the building projects that were happening in Stalin, that were like hallmarks of Stalinist industrialization. And that's when I thought, well, this is something that is like, it's so generally prevalent in the culture of this period that maybe it's worth investigating like as its own phenomenon. And then once I had that framework, I started to think about like, what does it mean that all of these references to liquids are everywhere?
Yeah, that's super interesting. And kind of going on to there's a concept you bring up of flow, which, as you say in your introduction, is developed by the Hungarian American psychologist Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi. Csikszentmihalyi.
Nice. Thank you did
you.
It.
I was trying to figure out how to arrange the questions so Cameron had to say that now.
if there's one thing I've learned from working in television news, it's the importance of a pronouncer. So you define flow in your book as the mental state of optimal labor productivity, a timeless and hyper-focused channeling of energy. And for any listeners that sounds a little familiar to you, it's because that was developed in the context of Chicago school neoliberalism and the American context. And you maybe feel and fear that in your own lives and how that works for your jobs. But you also understand this term flow as kind of a strange bedfellow of Stalinism. And I was wondering if you could talk about that relationship, because I assume the kind of subtitle for the introduction is drawn from this concept. So I was curious about the kind of prominent place it has.
Yeah, I mean, this was something very unexpected that came out of the book for me. Just like thinking about the way that so many of my frustrations with how work is organized in my own experience in like contemporary American society, it turns out that like drive for optimization, like the idea that human experience should be compartmentalized and like segmented and optimized in different ways. I mean, that's something like Michel Foucault talks about also in famously, right? In like Discipline and Punish and other works in that vein. But just the proximity of that desire to optimize human experience, both the experience of work and the experience of leisure, like that is a big underlying motivator for how Stalinist culture constructs itself. I still, despite having written about it in this book, I still don't totally know what to make of that, the fact that these things approach one another in this weird way, but it's definitely just true. Like Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi is he's like a corporate psychologist. That's like the type of thing that, I mean, he was also a researcher at the University of Chicago, actually around the same time that human capital theory was being developed at all, which I find like totally fascinating and something that I really want to explore further, actually. Like how much did he and like Milton Friedman and Gary Becker intersect during that period? But anyway, like that stuff has become it's just like cliched in any sort of discourse that you find around like how people should work now, right? People talk about, whether they call it being in the zone or, I mean, Csikszentmihalyi called it being in flow specifically, but just like the types of stuff that he talks about it's just like so, for me, it's really reminiscent of this other context that we don't like, supposedly. And yet this is supposed to be a doctrine that like leads us all to like greater prosperity, greater enjoyment of our free time, even.
It's so interesting. Sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, Matt. But this, as I was thinking about this, I realized that I'd heard of this before. And because you already made this connection to Silicon Valley, which as working around Silicon Valley and reporting on it, I'm well familiar and got a good chuckle out of that, this connection between Stalinism and Silicon Valley and this optimization of human potential. But I've also heard it, and like I've got friends who are kind of a little more hippie-ish. And that was where I think I heard the term originally, or they termed it flow state. And they would talk about that as like an optimization of whatever you're doing. And they were more so applying that to like skateboard, getting a flow state for skateboarding. But it's so
is it surprising to learn your friends might be Stalinists, Cameron?
Yeah, for that particular one, it'll be an interesting surprise for them. It's so funny how thoroughly this concept, I think, has not only in business culture, but just in casual conversation and in the ways it does, as you point out, replicate that sort of this Stalinist tendency to, all right, how can we optimize this human experience?
And nothing is too small to be optimized either. Think about the ubiquity of the idea of the life hack. Like anything can be hacked. Anything can be disrupted. Anything that you're doing, there's so many like versions of this, like you're doing it wrong. This is how you do it right. But it all comes down to the idea that our resources are finite and what we really need is to figure out how to use them most wisely, because nothing is worse than like wasted time or wasted energy. And like the implication is that if you're wasting any time or energy, then that's like, it's like you're cheating yourself or your boss or somebody. Like it's like a very weird ethic. Like if you think about who cares if you waste some, you know, whatever, like who cares if you waste some time? Who cares if you spend some time just like staring into space and daydreaming? No, everything has to be optimally constructed so that it never happens. What?
I totally get, I mean, just like recently, I think an interview we were airing was on, you know, AI. AI, I think, is such an interesting development on this, because the whole ethos is this, oh, we are going to help do our jobs more efficiently, even though if I remember the studies correctly, like the average American worker does do so much more work. It's just so much more efficient. We've all got nicer whatever setups. We've all got multiple screens. I work on 4 screens at work.
But oh my God.
And now you can do more, you know, more with less, but not certainly not getting paid more. But so that we're trying to like figure out how to make this less and less space. Do more and more. So I thought that was such a fascinating element of your book. I was so engaged with that.
Yeah, I'm
glad to hear it.
Personally, too, I'm interested in this, I don't know, call it East-West overlap, if you will. That's kind of what my own personal research touches on a little bit in 20s and 30s, too, on how so much of both systems are built on very similar aspects. And for me, I'm most interested in, or increasingly interested in, like, advertising and propaganda and that sort of overlap, which is quite similar too. It's just, I feel like a really interesting avenue that has not been explored very much, because it is maybe more comfortable to picture us as different than that bad stuff that was happening over there so many years ago.
No, alas. I mean, there's so much interesting cross-pollination, international cross-pollination that is happening in the 20s and 30s, because the thing about Stalinist industrialization, I mean, one of the things I talk about in the book is that Stalinist industrialization was sort of necessity biocentric, in the sense that it was all about the human body and not, you would think industrialization would be about like machines and technology. And there was some lip service to that, but underlying it was this very, it just was the reality that like so much of these industrialization projects would have to be performed by the like brute force of the human body, because there wasn't any machinery. What machinery there was, what sophisticated machinery there was, had to be imported. So it had to be bought. And where was it going? And like also technical specialists. So there's like a lot of like American and German engineers. Soviet Union during American and German machinery, to the extent that there's funds to buy it. And then there's also this fact that a lot of this like optimization discourse, the idea of rationalizing labor, so working more efficiently, especially in the factory, that's something that comes out of like American culture, Taylorism. Right, this extreme segmentation of time and space on the factory floor, down to individual motions that people were doing as they like perform their work. That stuff comes out of the American context, and then like Germany and the Soviet Union in the interwar period take it up in different ways and like grapple with the Americanism of it. And the fact that that stuff is like, you know, it's very different for it to exist in the capitalist context, where the point is presumably to save the like the factory owner on raw materials or resources or whatever. Like the Soviet Union, the concerns are very different, but it's very strange actually that same kind of like optimization drive becomes so important. And so then it's not surprising that it would come back in the very, you know, like in America, the place that, you know, invented this stuff.
Yeah, that's so interesting. You brought up, I forget at which point you bring up, Yuri, Yuri Ilyich's envy, And we covered that a long time ago, but as we talk about this more, I just like it becomes more like this dynamic between this drive to create a more a better, and this isn't a liquid, but like a better product, a more perfect union of price and nutrition, and then someone who feels wholly inadequate, not able to really catch up with the system, and this like this sort of neurosis that develops as a result of that. It feels more than I realized then more relevant in the context of how we're discussing. It's just so fascinating.
Yes. I mean, and in that case, first of all, I mean, envy is from the period where this stuff really starts to be important, 1927, like the end of new economic policy, like rolling into Stalin's consolidation of power and the beginning of the first five-year, like considering the first five-year plan and then implementing it. So that's exactly, like, that's the conflict. And you can tell that that conflict is affecting kind of like all layers of society in that work, because it's not just about, you know, the best sausage, the like fattest and juiciest sausage that like a Soviet meat plant can produce or whatever. It's also about this like conflict of culture. Like, what will culture look like?
Yeah.
In this new era. So it's there's no place is left unaffected by these like roiling problems.
Yeah, 1927. What a year! The most anxious year, perhaps. What a year! What a year!
Yeah.
So I think we've kind of touched on this, but I'm kind of interested because of the fact that you work not just in academic spaces, but you seem to be pretty dedicated to publishing, you know, outside of just academic manuscript, paywall journal, you know, the typical academic flair that we do, but published LA Review of Books, you know, public books, just all these other places. And in your introduction, there is this line where you talk about that you're trying to emphasize a certain marker of modernity, a tendency of social and political thought that transcends the Soviet case. And so I'm kind of curious how you see your role as a scholar in helping transcend this particular Soviet case. Like, what is this importance? And, you know, are we doing enough of it, maybe?
Yeah. Oh, you mean like as scholars,
sure,
in the like Slavic literature space?
Yeah.
I mean, no, we're not doing enough. We should do more, but it also, I mean, like it or not, our resources are in kind of a zero-sum balance, and there is a question of like how much time you could dedicate to what thing. For me personally, it was really important to write something that was not just going to be interesting to my colleagues, although of course it's very important that it be really actually interesting to my colleagues, and I hope it is.
Yeah.
My colleagues in the field. But it was important to me to write something where, like, someone, I mean, maybe this is like flattering myself, but like to write something where someone could potentially pick it up who didn't know anything about the topic and just get sucked into the intense weirdness and, frankly, like just like the similarities between that cultural moment and political moment and other ones in the 20th century and beyond. So even though there's a lot of like specific material in there that again is like hopefully interesting to a specialist, there's also general stuff. So I was trying to combine, to the extent that that's possible in an academic monograph, the kind of impetus to speak to a broader audience with, you know, deep knowledge of the subject matter.
Yeah. I definitely felt that in the book. I like that approach, of course. That's kind of, well, I mean, you know, not to the same level, but in some ways what we try to do here. That's why it's nice to have people like you on that can, you know, help us along that path for sure.
Yeah. So for any listeners out there, if this has been interesting to you, and I really hope it has, because I think getting people interested in early Soviet literature has been one of the sub goals of our podcast, you should pick this up. I mean, you know, a lot of stuff we've covered on the podcast before, it's all relevant here. So you should absolutely look it up, and you'll find a link to that in the description of the podcast.
Not to mention Magnitogorsk mentioned at least three times by my count. We have a strange fascination with Magnitogorsk on this podcast. Any city modeled after our beautiful Gary, Indiana.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. I mean, obviously, Stephen Kotkin with his, I'm sure you know it, his book on Magnitogorsk is like, that's like the ur text. But yeah, it's like definitely a fascinating project.
We have a poster for you if you.
It's funny that you like. It's funny that you bring that up. We were actually just talking about, I think you're talking about Steeltown USSR, just talking about that yesterday, funnily enough. So it all comes back to Stalinist labor culture. all right. Well, this is maybe this is a good time to start transitioning over to talking about the story itself. Or before we get into the story, maybe we should start with its author, Daniil Kharms. And I was wondering if you could kind of talk about where he fits or maybe he doesn't really fit into his Soviet literary scene of his time.
Yeah, I mean, he fits in one way because he is a famous author of children's books, like a lot of members of the earlier avant-gardes ended up kind of pigeonholed in children's literature by the end of the 20s and beginning of the 30s, because that was kind of the only way that they could make a living doing what they did, namely write or create drawings or whatever, write poetry. So you end up with children's literature that is of surprisingly, even insanely high quality. And it's because all these people who like weren't allowed to work in other more quote unquote serious domains ended up with this as their like primary source of income. And Kharms is someone like that because his actual work was not digestible by even the like in the even more sort of liberal and relatively free-flowing atmosphere of the earlier 20s. And in fact, when he was arrested, his first arrest in 1931, one of the accusations leveled against him is almost this like Socratic one of like corrupting the youth with his like confusing nonsense poetry, right? So he definitely doesn't fit, not only because he is not allowed to publish basically, but also because he himself and his friends develop an idiosyncratic artistic self-conception where they are almost deliberately not fitting in, right? They occupy, their group calls themselves the Chinari, which comes from the Russian word chin, meaning rank. So they kind of like appropriate this alternative rank for themselves, like an alternative position outside what is becoming, you know, the dominant official way of writing, even, you know, at the end of the 20s. So yeah, and he's also known, but I mean, I think to the extent that he's known to like American readers, he is considered kind of an absurdist, writer of like little vignettes, absurd poems, little short stories that are very weird. That's how I came to enjoy him personally. It's like as someone with a very particular and odd vision of the world.
Yeah, I that would be how I would say I came to Kharms as well. That was at least my preconception of him prior to reading him, and also after reading him, I guess. So, <you know. laughs> and this is fortunate that we were able to talk about him and our short story in the context of your book, because not only was it a major chapter of your book, but also an article that you had written prior to the book, which is great. So I was kind of wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on his idea of word machines and that sort of linkage to the first 5-year plan. How does this all kind of tie in with the idea of energy, flow, and liquid? I'm kind of interested in, right, like his sort of approach to writing, his sort of, you know, ideas and how that connects to your broader points here.
So Hans, in the sense, is a true modernist in that he thinks a lot about the structure of language, and he also has great faith in the poetic word as something that can, like, break down barriers. He talks about it as, you know, true real poetry is poetry that you can use like a physical object, like it can break a pane of glass, right? So in that sense, like, word machines are, I mean, it's clear that he's thinking about them in the same sort of general context as machines that can be used to perform industrial tasks or like technical tasks, calculation machines, right? So it comes back to his, it's like this like totemic occult, almost like Kabbalistic faith in the power of symbols, even symbols that don't have necessarily concrete linguistic meaning. So we can, in this sense, tie Harms to other poets and writers like of his time, like the transrational poets, all these poets like in the, you know, early 20th century who were like, what if a poem was just weird sounds? Like, what if we conveyed meaning without the like semantic context that we're all familiar with? Also ties into things like defamiliarization, for example, right? Like the idea of dehabituating ourselves from the things that we're like used to aesthetically and therefore perhaps socially and politically. So Hans is coming out of that like broader context of extreme investment in language, which by the way, mainstream Soviet culture also shared, right? The reason that it became so important to standardize the poetic and more generally fictional word is like, you don't do that unless you really think that it has significant power, right? This is something that isn't that something Mandelstam said that like Russia is the only, like the respect for poets is extreme in Russia. You would actually be like killed for your poetry. I don't know if I'm quoting it correctly, and perhaps it's not even Mandelstam who said it, but I have an association with Mandelstam. But
it's a quote I vaguely heard.
Yeah,
sometime.
It's like one of those, you know, it's like floating in the ether. But so that's what Harms is really like genuinely, sincerely invested in all of that, and for that reason, like he takes the word both not seriously enough for the context that he unfortunately has to live in, and too seriously.
That's interesting. Especially I like in scholarship, it feels like a lot of value and emphasis tends to be placed on kind of how subversive we can make an artist out to be, especially this time, this era. So something we liked about your book and this chapter in particular is the way when you, as you've said before, that there are definitely overlaps between this, the public methods, loosely termed a Stalinist method for the purposes of this podcast, and like Harm's method here of, you know, both of them are kind of talking about these energies inherent in these features. With Stalinism, you have this more work-oriented, like, let's how we turn this human energy into potential. Harm's, it's like, how do we kind of turn this word potential into just transformational? And so something we liked is how you talk about with how there are some subversions, but not necessarily everything is a subversion. You kind of write towards the end of the chapter, even where he stages resistance to Stalinist norms, Harms subjects his own creative production to the dominant ideology of labor, in effect subscribing to the standards of a society that marginalized and ultimately destroyed him. I just wonder if you could talk a little bit more on that, because that's such a fascinating, like, it's a tough gray area to exist in as an artist.
Yeah, I mean, this is the tragedy of existing in an optimization state. Like a state that forces optimization on you in one way or another, that there is no way to escape the dominant paradigms of your time. We all know that. Like, we can't escape this like life hack stuff. There's no way to get away from it. Even if you vehemently disagree that it's like a good idea, you still have to perform capitalism. You still have to like fill out timesheets. You still have to do reports of different kinds. Like you have to do all that stuff. And Harms like similarly existed in the time that he was born in. And so while it's true, and he writes explicitly about how much he dislikes proletarian culture, and it's like very clear that in a lot of his work, he's like mocking and denigrating that like extreme sort of just like the Philistinism that he perceives as being like the dominant note of the culture of his time. You know, he talks about the newspaper propaganda printed on bad splintery paper, right? So, but he still exists in that framework. So he definitely thinks of his own work in terms of optimization. Like he needs to channel his energy appropriately because he has personal goals that may be completely at odds with the goals of the culture at large as it was coalescing around him. But he wants to accomplish them, and he knows that he can't do that unless he organizes his time in a particular way. So he does. You know, he keeps those like diaries where he writes like, today I wrote nothing. It's very relatable. All of us who do academic work, which is like the idea that you come to the end of a day and you're like, I did not do anything today.
Don't tell my advisor.
Yeah, I think what an interesting note you pointed out is that he had a habit of like whenever he finished something at work, he'd sign it or date it and all that. And like that's also just like I feel like I want to resist this tendency, you know, like, oh, we don't all need to be super optimized, but also at the same time, whatever. When I go to work, I have my four monitors and I immediately open up one. Like I have every day I organize like documents by day. So I do all my writing in one document. So I know exactly what day I wrote something and what version I wrote it in. Like,
yep.
So I understand
that. Did you know, you probably know this better than I do, but there's like so much software out there that helps you. It's like meta organizational tasks so that you can like keep track, especially if you're working in a group, like who said what, when, what status different tasks have. It's funny to think about what Harms would do if he had like access to these affordances. Like how, you know, he was just writing in sometimes in school notebooks. He often actually did lack both like paper and ink to write with. So.
You're right. There's a whole industry on this of these task managers that my brain, for whatever reason, is somewhat drawn to. I know there's one called Asana. I think this was their slogan, is trying to reduce work about work, which is the work that you do to coordinate your work. And all I could think about that is the only reason this exists is because you exist.
Yes.
If there was no program, there would not be work about work.
That's right.
I don't think, not in the same way that. You know, it is. So they're creating a solution for a problem that they created.
It's all mechanisms of surveillance and control. Mm-hmm. And they want to devolve it onto each person to do to themselves.
Right.
Right. And does this creep into your kind of conception of lifestyle fascism? I know this is not totally related to Harms, but I find it so fascinating.
Yeah. It's all kind of related. Like this idea that there doesn't need to be an authoritarian government. It doesn't need to be like that that like Apple ad based on 1984 or whatever, where like someone is like telling you what to wear and what to do. Because if you make it possible and even necessary for each person to optimize themselves, then there doesn't need to be like a centralized, you know, Stalin type authority handing down orders from above, because each person will again like do it to themselves. One of the things I talk about in the book is that actually these like models for internalizing discipline and developing self-discipline, they are already being evolved in 19th century Russian literature. So like Tolstoy, speaking of, you know, keeping a diary, Tolstoy was a big diarist. Drove himself to like the brink of insanity, trying to record his every thought to like root out, you know, possible sources of like problems or temptation, or like immorality, right? And like the vocabulary's changed, but these mechanisms are very modern. Like this idea that you would like do some sort of like general inventory of your thoughts and then like take away the ones that are bad. That's the premise of Zymatin's We, like the first science fiction novel, right? Like the idea is that you just, in the future, it will be possible to inventory our thoughts and then just like remove the ones that are wrong. So it doesn't have to be from above in that way. It can be from below. And that's that's what I mean when I talk about lifestyle fascism, just like the fact that the experience of, becoming like super ripped or whatever can be like a pleasant consumer experience. It doesn't have to be, you're not doing it like on like some sort of plaza for Il Duce. You're doing it theoretically for yourself, but it's not, but you're also doing it kind of for everyone too.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and that kind of is a, again, tangential point to what, when we covered We at one point, Cameron made this point that I thought was really good about how we will very happily trade our sort of individual freedoms for convenience. And it's, yeah, just it all kind of starts to tie together in a way that makes it hard to unsee the similarities between what we have now and what we had allegedly been looking at for so long, thinking, oh, this is so bad, this would never happen to us. When, you know, we like to think we're so smart, we're above this, we're above that. No, it turns out.
No, I mean, it's, you know, it's partly because none of these time periods are discontinuous or discrete. Like they all, each one is naturally produced by the one that preceded it. So just like none of the 19th century stuff goes away just because the Bolshevik Revolution happened, like none of this, or much of the Soviet stuff doesn't exactly just disappear after 1991. Like similarly, just because we're in a new century and we have more sophisticated electronic tools doesn't mean that the like prior forms of social practice or ways of thinking have gone away, especially when people, you know, like contemporary, I have yet to find like the smoking gun that proves this definitively, but I really would be surprised if some of the people, some of the like transhumanist, you know, optimizers of humanity in Silicon Valley today aren't borrowing from some modernist texts in some way. I don't know which ones exactly, but it just feels like a very similar impulse.
Yeah, well, it's kind of, this is also sort of tangential, but, you know, speaking on the way, like, we use literature for that, we probably shouldn't do this, we engage with people on Twitter who are like, let me tell you, my whole thing is I read books, and let me tell you, I read old books, let me tell you what they mean for you. Like, here's how you can take away, it's not, you don't need to enjoy them, here's your modern takeaway, and for whatever reason, strangely, it always seems to line up exactly with whatever reactionary viewpoint they already had.
and it's very convenient.
Yeah,
we have some accounts for you if you'd like to.
I don't know if you want them.
If you need a day where you don't want to write and you just want to pull your hair out,
become angry on Twitter.
But it's so interesting that you kind of bring that up, because so many of these people I noticed, they're kind of, I don't know if they're actually in Silicon Valley, but they certainly style themselves in the same way. They're like talking to those crowds, and it makes almost all literature like, it reduces it down from its own product, its own piece, just how does it fit into making your life better? And invariably, the advice it gives you is not also good, too. It's just like, work harder or something.
Yeah,
or
yeah.
Like,
yeah. Like, what kinds of books are they reading?
You know, well, so it's, I guess our most relevant example is the other day we were, as for fun, for a lark, we were reading this, I won't name it, but just like this book of like, okay, there's 70 books, like, well, here's how you can take old lessons. And the thing we went into and realized is they're not actually reading really books. They're like thinking about those books, because they'll like,
oh, wow,
bring up War and Peace, for example, and they'll tell you some like very like surface level analysis of like what Tolstoy's trying to do. And then like five chapters later, they'll be like, here's why it's really important for us to conceive of ourselves as modern Napoleons without the slightest hint of irony.
Oh my God, that's amazing. That's incredible.
Yeah. Well, I mean, realistically, what they're reading, it's Nietzsche, Dostoevsky, Jordan Peterson.
Yeah.
It's yes,
I also doubt they're reading Dostoevsky. I think they're reading, no. I think they're listening to Jordan Peterson about Dostoevsky. Otherwise, they'd
like
know.
Jordan Peterson hasn't read Dostoevsky.
Right, and you know he hasn't, because he also doesn't say his name right. And this is the thing that I've noticed, is anyone who's learned about Dostoevsky from Jordan Peterson makes that same, like, I don't know, like, how he pronounces
Dostoevsky.
That second O, but it's, yeah, he's got that extra, like, you know, something in there.
Weird.
That I will hear. Yeah. That's just something I've noticed from grad school.
But yeah, I don't know if that's fully relevant, but it's so funny you bring that up, just almost the ways in which literature is sort of weaponized for this, to the same angle. War and Peace isn't about what it's about. It's about making your life better.
Yeah. What's interesting to me about that is that it's still important to, the appeal to authority is still important. It's important to be able to say, like, you know, it's not that I personally desire to imitate Napoleon. It's that big, important writer Tolstoy and this like incredibly fat book that I didn't actually read recommend. That's what he recommends. So that's like, that's how we know that that's the right thing to do. It's like, why?
Right.
He's like weird 19th century dude who like made his own boots and like seriously considered like not using indoor plumbing. Why him?
Maybe you just have a really weird fascination with drinking like gallons of kumis and right. You know.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Muscle, yeah. Tolstoy. Yeah.
That's a frightening thought.
Tolstoy wasn't getting ripped for anyone, just himself.
The only person in history to truly do it. Okay, well, let's take it back to Harms for a second. I'm happy to keep talking about this, but so talking about how the old woman tried to buy ink. Just for people who haven't read it, I'll include a link in the description of this episode to an online copy. But the basic version is there is an old woman, her husband and son have died, who always used to bring her ink, and she's out, and she needs to go buy some. And so she does it. She goes out to try to buy ink, and no one has it until she gets to finally the, I guess, I don't know if it's stated or heavily implied to be the Writers Union, in which that case they trade her story for some ink, which is how this very story happens to come about. She's a nice, neat little tale.
Yeah, it's recursive, right? It goes back to its own beginning at the end.
Yeah, which as I understand it, it's sort of a children's tale, and just like the narrative, I don't know, the narrative interest is, I see what you mean earlier when you see like the talent in many of such work at this time from people who are kind of forced into doing it.
Yeah, it's a super interesting story, actually. I feel like it has a lot of value beyond just being a children's story, or it fits into a lot of Harms's other work. Harms is a really playful author. So it may even his work that's supposedly nominally for adults contains a lot of the same elements that make his work for children so like fun. It's like play with language, absurd situations, unexpected collisions and coincidences.
Yeah. I felt a little bad sometimes laughing, but there are just some moments where I'm like, this is really, I don't like the old woman. She's like trying to talk to the guy, the street sweeper, who just keeps accidentally like spraying the water in her direction. I don't know why that like that struck me as particularly funny, but it did for whatever reason. One of the elements of the story that kind of interests me is that there's sort of a ink is the main refrain throughout the story, but there's a lot of repetitious elements. I mean, the whole story itself is a repetition in itself. But there's also a constant refrain that this old lady must have fallen from the moon. Do you think there's like significance to the phrasing or cultural fascination with outer space of that era?
Yeah, I was thinking about that too, because when I was rereading the story just now, that really jumped out at me, because it strikes me as just as being like, it's more than just, you know, the story is constructed around the fact that she's like looking for ink and can't find it. So you sort of expect that element to recur. But I think to me, I didn't think about, fascination with outer space or cosmism or travels to the moon or any of that. There's a lot of sort of like cosmist energy in the very early post-revolutionary period, because there's so much discourse about literally building a new world, like this, the idea of like a new planet, a new red planet, global revolution. Alexander Bogdanov's science fiction novel Red Star, which is from earlier, but it nonetheless, right? It's like this imagination of socialist revolution as being a global project and therefore maybe a cosmic project somehow. So that I didn't think of any of that when I was reading the story. Instead, I thought about the fact that the main character in the story, the old lady, is someone she's outside of her time in a way. Like she exists, she does not fit into her environment. So we learn early that she lives alone. Her son is grown and gone and her husband is dead. She says at some point in the story that she used to get ink from her husband and now he's gone. So he can't be her source of ink anymore. Ties in with this idea of like ink as this like mystical fluid of sexual energy or poetic inspiration also. At the end, when the character who sort of physically resembles Harms by being like tall and thin and whose shoelaces are constantly coming untied, also I noticed that as a repeated detail too. He can't keep he keeps tying his shoelaces and they keep coming untied. He's able to give away the ink because the old lady kind of like relinquishes her story to him. So he doesn't need the creative inspiration anymore because he got it from the old lady. So he can afford to give away some of his ink. So that transaction can take place because those are two things of like equivalent value in a way. But her having fallen from the moon, it's like she may as well be a space alien for all that she is able to fit into the new Soviet reality. And we get kind of as she traverses the city in search of ink, we get kind of a tour of the new reality. We see a market that is very abundant with very specifically described food. This is like, maybe it's like an artifact of new economic policy era life where like there was some private enterprise and like, you know, slightly less sparse conditions. We also see that this old lady can't coexist with technology. She nearly gets run over by cars or by like trolley buses in one sequence. She gets sprayed with the water because she can't fit into the rhythms of normal life. So she comes from like the dark side of life, the moon side maybe. So that's how I read that, just as a marker of her being alien in this environment. And also she can't find ink. She goes to all the wrong places to look for ink. She goes to the fish market to look for ink.
Well, you never know. Maybe.
Maybe.
Maybe they would.
Right.
Who knows?
Right. So she's someone who approaches the world in this like totally like naive and playful way, like a child. Right. Why not? Why not?
Yeah. It reminded me of like some just this, you know, early poetry on the city and what it was like. And it has a sort of same kind of defamiliarizing aspect to the reader when you're kind of going through it. And although I guess it's, you know, theoretically different because she's an old lady and so she should have seen maybe a city by now, but who knows? You never know. Lots of people come to the city.
She lives in the city, right? She lives in Leningrad, we know.
Yes.
So she should know. She should, but she doesn't, but it's like clear she doesn't get out much, right?
Mm-hmm. And I think that's fair though, because I think the pace at which everything kind of industrialized, especially in the 20s, is kind of difficult to comprehend for most people. And I always say this to my students too, like, you've always lived at a time where you've had this. You've never conceptually lived where this didn't exist. I said like film or different aspects of it, but even the sort of modern city.
Yeah.
We've always had a modern city, so we've never experienced what it's like to walk into a, you know, a NEP era fish market, I suppose.
Yeah. Yeah.
But in your book, you offered the analysis that the tall, skinny writer who resembles Harms and much like Harms complains of having nothing to write about, trades the material required to physically produce writing form for the substance of the story content. And you kind of noted it as a potential metaphor for writer's block, which definitely could, I mean, that's definitely could be the case. That was one idea that I had as I was reading. But I was also kind of wondering what it might mean for this old woman to be deprived of the means by which to write her own story, and the way the story itself becomes commodity throughout the kind of short story. And that was kind of what stuck out to me, especially, and I think in the context of our larger conversation, which I could not escape as I was reading the book, because it was, you know, that's an ever-present and important aspect of it, of what that sort of means, what that relationship is. And as we talk about kind of authoritarian systems, lifestyle fascism, the way that it sort of will kind of creep into all aspects of our life, and all parts of you and your experience can be ultimately commodified.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I guess we don't know why she needs the ink, right? It's not clear why she needs it. Maybe she wants to write a letter to her son. We don't know that it's because she wants to write down her own story. Something else that just occurred to me is that when the tall, skinny writer at the end is complaining that he has nothing to write about, maybe what is happening there is that he's like, I don't have anything acceptable to write about. Like, I don't have anything that I can write down that would be okay in this context. And what the old lady's story offers him is the possibility of writing down it's literature of fact, right? It's the option to write something down that doesn't depart into some like weird nonsense arena, or some like unacceptably fantastical context. It's literally the story of what happened to one person over the course of a single day doing a mundane task. And any fantastical elements are can only be attributed to the reality itself.
Yeah, that is an interesting thought, right? What does literature of fact look like when you almost like it has the same form, but it's aesthetically it's different than what say Sergei Tretyakov was writing in the 20s of literature of fact. It would not have looked like an old lady falling from the moon, I don't think.
Sorry, I'm breaking up the flow here, but I don't know, Matt, I don't know if you want to take on the next question.
Sure, sure. Oh, yeah, because I strung together three unrelated thoughts. Yeah, so I kind of have a sort of concluding bridge between the story, I think, and some of the larger things that we've been talking about. Because for me, I do think that in some ways, part of this story, some aspects of the story might be able to be read through this lens of labor, potentially. And there's this really great quote in your conclusion chapter that says, labor has retained this privileged ideological position, even amid mass deindustrialization and the outsourcing, de-skilling, and pseudo-intellectualization of most forms of work. And I thought that was a really great, concise way of sort of putting that thought. And I think it's an interesting comparison between how labor might be valorized in, like you said, literature of fact, and how all these different forms, Ochirk, and everything that's being written at this time that has this sort of documentary bent to it, meshes with how we sort of viewed, especially this was what immediately came to mind, was our essential workers during COVID, all of these like big corporations that were not paying anybody more. Yep. And instead put all their money into making like commercials valorizing like different types. And I don't want to speak too ill of our heroes, because Cameron was a hero during that time.
UC Davis put me to work in the sweatshops of their mask making production.
Wow. Really?
Yeah. Well, God. I was a student. I was working as a student when the pandemic kicked in, and then everyone was furloughed from their jobs, and they're like, hey, we also need masks for the medical center. So any student who was furloughed, you could go in, and then we were setting up stations. Very interestingly, kind of tailor stations where we'd have one section for cutting up t-shirts, one section for setting up a certain way, one section for sewing, one section, different, similar thing for making masks. Yeah. And then from there into a couple years of healthcare. So, which
amazing.
Makes, and I can tell you, as someone who's working in healthcare in the COVID years in person the whole time, that this was a very hollow. I mean, we all know it's hollow, but if you weren't in healthcare at that time, let me tell you, it was indeed very, very hollow.
Yes.
Yeah. Sentiment. But anywho.
Yeah, so that kind of quote made me think of how relevant it was to just our situation, like literally 2, 3, 4 years ago. I don't know what year it is. Counting up back to 2020. There.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had to read that question because I had to thank Cameron for the service.
I used to,
I don't know if you saw any kind of connections between this short story. I know it's a little bit hard to talk about one specific Cottam story without bringing in maybe many, many others, or, you know, kind of talk about this in the larger theme of the book, because it touches on quite a lot of different authors. But between that question of labor then and now labor now, I just feel like it is pressing. Stress me out,
frankly. Yeah. Mission accomplished. I mean, I guess I see, like many other people, I see that there are, you know, it's like that Velvet Underground song where he goes, there are problems in these times, but none of them are mine. Like that's how it feels. Like and not among many other people, I perceive various like terrible, seemingly intractable problems, but I don't have the means to anything other than just kind of like gesture at them or describe them maybe. So I don't know. There just seems to be an irresolvable conflict between the profit motive and the good of the majority. And I don't know what could possibly happen to uncouple those things.
Yeah, it's a point well taken. I think, especially as you say, the kind of, and maybe I think there is value in bringing this awareness to people because I think maybe sometimes it seems obvious, then you can maybe talk to someone who hasn't really experienced it before, and that it sort of can be a revelation. But yeah, especially as you pointed out, the pseudo intellectualization. I don't know if you had meant something particular, but when I read that, what I was immediately thinking of is how every job now needs a more advanced degree.
Yes, every job needs a more advanced degree. It's like because there, I think that I was channeling David Graeber's, the late great David Graeber's Bullshit Jobs book, right? Like just the idea that so much of the work that gets done and paid for is like make work. And yet at the same time, there are just like masses of things that urgently need to be done. And that those are not paid for or acknowledged, really.
Right. Not that I have no particular commentary on university systems in general, but just as an example, my girlfriend works events for a university around here, and her counterpart position in every other department. She's got a BA in English, but she was hired on because she has experience in events. So she does a lot of work. Every other department that has a counterpart role, that role is empty for all of them because they all require master's degrees and then are paying very badly, which is strange. Wow. For putting events together, where they would do those two things, but they have a lot of money for hiring more administrators, so that's good. They can't put events together, but they can. they can investigate.
My department, I think, thinks certain tasks are more complex than they are because they haven't done those tasks in quite a while.
Wow.
Anyway, so not speaking on industries and universities in general, just a random example.
Yeah, I mean, I think.
Oh, never mind. Mine's not my department.
I mean, where you can find it wherever you look. I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So pressing and painful. That's a good question. So as we're kind of wrapping up, the final question in your book is you pose at this historical phase, what will it take to defeat the ideology that immiserates free societies as easily as totalitarian ones? And we've been kind of already talking about that we don't know, but I think as a first step, the awareness of this and maybe kind of opening up this conversation and it's pressing this tough spot, because I think talking about Stalinism as we do in this book, I think what you've already done is something that can be a little tough among scholarly people, but even among the average person for, you know, whom Cold War attitudes are surprisingly still pretty relevant. I get asked at work, what do Russian people think of the party fairly often? And people are surprised to find out that there is not communist rule, which is a little disconcerting considering the industry I work in. But I won't comment on that either here or there. And if you're my employer, So I think, I guess I don't really have a question. Just thinking about that I was going to pose it to you, but we kind of already talked about it. But I do think there is really real value in discussing it in the ways that you do in this book.
That's great to hear. I think the best we can do as do our job as scholars, right? And surface stuff that maybe wouldn't be obvious to the casual layperson reader and explain it in ways that are interesting to look at. Maybe that's like a big part of it, is just like, I think so many difficult problems are also difficult to focus on because they're so enormous and horrible to contemplate, and because of that they almost become boring. So one thing that I think we really need to do is to continue to find things to make these like truisms compelling, like the planet is falling apart. I just think people tune that out. There has to be maybe that's our job, is to make it, defamiliarize it, right? Make it urgent for people to look at it again.
Yeah.
Yeah. And maybe scholarship is like the last bastion of freedom, in the sense that, I don't know about you, but for me, I can say I go about it incredibly inefficiently at every turn.
Actually,
I stumble over myself like you would not believe.
I think that inefficiency is actually an enormous part of creative work. This is the thing that
I would agree.
This is the thing that that drives me so insane when I read Csikszentmihalyi, to like go back to the beginning of our conversation, is that he, not only does he want to impose this optimization regime on work time, he wants you to only have certain kinds of fun, because like he like is upset about like rock and roll music or whatever. You're like, because it doesn't like stimulate, or like television. He's like, television is a total waste of your, it doesn't put you in the flow state. And you're like, but sometimes you can't do that 100% of the time. The body and the mind need rest, and they need just inefficient daydreaming time.
I try to explain that to my parents, and they're like, well, can't you just write this many pages every day? And I'm like, theoretically, I could.
If I just type gibberish, sometimes sure.
Sometimes I need to spend, like, a few days just following footnote trails, seeing where I go.
That's right.
I generate 5 different paper ideas that I'll never write, and then back to the task at hand.
Yeah, long live loafing.
Yeah.
I think that's a good place to leave it. That is, there are many great points to bring it in here, but most importantly is consider an efficiency as an essential part of your job routine.
That's right.
Try to make your job and your coworkers' jobs a little more interesting.
Yeah. That's funny. It's also something we're covering in Life and Fate recently, but you know, what's something we usually do at the end of these episodes is we kind of ask, is there anything you want to talk about, some stuff that you've got coming out, people that people should look forward to?
I don't have anything coming out imminently, but like if you liked this, you might love googling my name and seeing other stuff. So yeah.
There we go. That's your call to action.
Exactly.
I did see that. I'm always impressed when I see other like people that are like, not that I knew you really before this, although we did work together on one Jordan.
We did,
thing,
yeah.
But like when I see other people I know from the field, when they pop up different places, and I saw your name in Deckman just unrelatedly, and I was like, holy shit, that's awesome. Like,
thank you.
Nice. Good for the Academy.
Yes, I hope so.
Great. Well, thank you so much for being here today. Thank you for taking the time out of your day. Thank you for this book being sent over to us. It is such a joy to read.
Thank you so much. It was really my pleasure to talk to you. I really appreciate your podcast, and thanks for inviting me.
Literally anytime.
All right.
And before we totally wrap up, we just wanted to remind you all that next week there will be no episode, but the next installment of our Life and Fate series will be coming out on the last Friday of the month. That'll be the 26th, so you can look forward to hearing your next big dose of Grossman. I guess you're already getting a lot of little doses, so it wouldn't be accurate to say that you're getting the next dose. Anyway, to help keep our show independent and for exclusive access to notes containing all of the research that went into this episode, head on over to our website, slaviclitpod.com. Before we let you go, we also wanted to extend a sincere thank you to all of our current supporters, Camille, Emma, Lauren, Erica, Michelle, Juliana, Diane, Oleg, John, Timex, Melissa, Baron, Aldo, Ben, Gabe, George, Claire, Amy, Allie, Soraya, Jackson, Molly, Emma, Mike, Marianne, Mickey, Eric, Reagan, Mike, Peter, Eric, Ben, Claire, Jeff, Inez, Mai, Robert, Joseph, Daniel, Lou, Nina, Gary, Janice, Mary, Anne, Isaac, Emily, Amanda, Caitlin, Yitza, Irini, and Pack Rob. Ooh, struggling to get to the end there, but we made it. The music used in this episode was Staraya Kino by Peremotka. You can find more of their stuff on Bandcamp or Spotify. The links and spelling are in the show notes. Hey, 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 hey.